Hi there, I'm Carolyn Spring and welcome to my podcast where I talk about all things trauma. I dig into the nuts and bolts of trauma, how we can recover, what blocks us, and all things neuroscience-y, what actually goes on in the body and brain during and after trauma, especially from the perspective of evolutionary neurobiology. This podcast is for anyone who's experienced trauma or knows someone who has, which is pretty much everyone. For more podcasts, blog posts, books, and training, check out my website at carolynspring.com. Okay, let's get going. So I've got some questions that have been sent in. So the first one, how can a client learn to tolerate positive emotions when they find them triggering? And I think this is such a great question because I think that's so common. You know, we can think in terms of how to tolerate negative feelings. We can, you know, think in terms of how do we deal with distress? How do we deal with being kind of triggered from fear-based things or reminders of the abuse and so on? But actually a huge part of it for me, as for I think lots of people, is how to deal with when something good is happening and that sense of fear and anticipation of dread and kick back from that. Certainly for me, whenever something positive happened, there was almost always kickback from that. There was like a sense of sheer terror and panic. It's like, oh my word, this good thing has happened. Something bad must happen now, almost to balance it up. And so you end up dreading good things happening. And so you've got this kind of conflict within the therapeutic setup where therapeutically we're trying to work towards life getting better and good things happening. But we end up in this cycle that the more good things happen, the more triggered you get. And so you end up in this awful kind of catch-22 situation. And I think for me, the starting point on it wasn't, as I say on lots of things, wasn't to try to change it. It was just to notice it, just to be able to kind of go, oh, look, there's that dynamic again, that I've got something to look forward to, something positive has happened, and I've got that backlash that's coming in again. Oh, okay, that's just what happens. That's what happens for me. It's what happens for many other trauma survivors. It's part of the dynamic of trauma. So just the noticing it to start with, rather than trying to fix it and then getting into that spiral again of beating ourselves up for having the reaction. So I think that's where we can end up spiraling almost off to one side, where we go, oh, look, this positive thing's happened. I'm having backlash to it. Now I'm beating myself up for the backlash. And so the triggering has become double triggering, becomes triple triggering, rather than being able to just kind of go, oh, yeah, is that thing again. That's what happens. It's what happens for lots of people. It's not just me. I think so. I started with just noticing it and trying to be more accepting of it and compassionate towards myself in it. You know, taking that attitude of yeah, that's really hard that I've got this lovely thing that's just happened or is about to happen. And instead of being able to enjoy that, I've got this, you know, reaction. And isn't that really sad? And isn't that really painful that I've had so many bad things happen to me in life that's my innate response to good things happening? So having that kind of sense of compassion for myself in it, not what's wrong with me and why do I have to be like this, but just like, oh, how painful is that? And so then from that much more kind of compassionate, accepting, noticing stance and being curious about it, starting to look for, well, I wonder why that's happening. And I think there's a kind of different energies in that, again, that we can kind of go, right, well, why is it happening? Because I need to figure out why it's happening so that I can stop it happening, so that I can be better, so that I'm not so triggered all the time, so I'm not so bad, so I'm not so messed up. And, you know, again, what I'm talking about here is just the gentle curiosity of like, oh, wonder why that's happening. And I think that triggering can happen for a whole raft of reasons. You know, certainly for me, I think for lots of people, when you've been groomed in child sexual abuse, it's often the positive thing that's offered and then the bad thing happens afterwards. You know, you are tempted in with sweets, with treats, with affection. You're set up for a treat, for something positive to happen, and actually it's just a prelude to abuse. So of course you start associating good things with something good will happen, and then afterwards, straight away, I will have to pay for it. Something bad is coming. So there's a kind of a conditioned response there. I see something good. What's happening next? There's something bad. I think as well, another reason for the triggering on it is that we get used to things being bad. We get used to suffering. We get used to being in distress. And so just the fact that it's different to that, that can trigger a sense of unsafety. Our back brain is going, I don't recognize this. I don't know what it is. I can't imagine what's going to happen now. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what the rules are. I don't know what this is. This good thing, this good feeling.
Yeah, like
what is that? And so anything that's novel, anything that's unfamiliar, is likely to trigger that same response of threat and danger, and I need to be very wary of it. So it takes some time to get used to good things happening. And again, understanding that that's probably what's going to go on, and anticipating it and saying, okay, when this good thing that I'm planning is going to happen, I'm going to go somewhere that I want to go. I'm going to, receive a gift that I really want. I'm going to have a nice time with someone. It's like kind of going, okay, my back brain is probably going to interpret this as dangerous and unsafe. It may even then sabotage it to stop it happening in order to keep me safe. But it's not that that reaction is because inherently I don't deserve the good thing. It's just my back brain just trying to keep me safe from this novelty of something good. So we have to kind of get used to it and learn to tolerate it a little bit. But I think as well, just the positive emotions in that is can be really unfamiliar as well. And when we've lived in the numbed out red zone of freeze and dissociation and not having feelings, then having feelings and those feelings even sort of manifesting, in terms of smiling and laughing and enjoying, that can feel really, really dangerous. If our survival strategy has been to play dead, to go still, to hunch down small, to huddle down so that the predator doesn't take notice of us, then this sort of very dangerous way of being, of having emotions and having positivity and having joy, making a noise, that can feel incredibly dangerous as well. So even just having those positive emotions can trigger the back brain to thinking, whoa, what are you doing? You're just going to draw attention to yourself. It's like if you're used to walking through woods where bears come and maul you, you don't want to be walking through woods skipping and laughing and dancing and being joyful, because that's going to cause bad things to happen again. So, and as I said earlier as well, the sense of I don't deserve good things, that core belief. So if I'm experiencing good things, well, the world's just turned upside down and I can't predict what's going to happen now, because it shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't experience good things. And when you work with a therapist who's had maybe more positive life experiences, and, for me, I saw this kind of mirroring coming back to me of someone who did believe that she deserved good things. And when she had good things, it was the most natural thing in the world. And instead, she had this sense of, I don't deserve bad things. You don't deserve bad things. That was really helpful to have that mirroring come back to me of, of having someone who, in a very careful and therapeutic way, had a level of self-disclosure that showed me, when these bad things happen to you, I don't think that's right. I don't think you deserve those things. And when I said, oh, there's this good thing that I'm about to have or enjoy or do, to see the delight and the joy and the kind of almost as well, the shrug shoulders of like, yeah, of course you should have a nice birthday. Of course you should have a nice holiday. Of course you should have a nice evening out. Of course. That to me was really surprising, because it didn't fit those core beliefs that I grew up with, that I don't deserve good things. you know, an example, it probably links into what I said just a few minutes ago, that a lot of my memories around things like birthdays were, you know, I lived with, well, my granddad lived with us as a family. My granddad was one of my abusers. And on my birthday, he'd give me money for, you know, as a birthday present. And the rule in the family was you had to go and say thank you to him, and you had to go up to his room to say thank you to him. And almost without fail, every time I did, I would be abused. And so, of course, within that, I didn't want to receive a good thing because I didn't want to have to pay for it afterwards. I never really, growing up, had a sense that I could receive a good thing and it was just a good thing for me to enjoy. There was always a cost attached to it. There was always a debt to pay for it. So I'd rather not have the good thing in the first place so that I didn't have to pay for it afterwards. You know, so that you know, that's another factor in it. Another one, just thinking more on this. I think if we've not had our emotions accurately labeled to us, if we've not had experiences of joy, and then we've had an attachment figure who has responded with joy to our joy as a child and called it joy or enjoyment or happiness, then that lack of epistemic mirroring can leave us very confused about what it is that we're experiencing. You know, I can think of many, many times in childhood when I had a joyful experience, you know, winning a race in sports day, something like that. And you come bubbling with this excitement. You come home bubbling with this excitement to say what happened. You come home with a piece of so-called art that you've produced, that you're proud of, that you enjoyed making. And when that's not mirrored back to you, when what's mirrored back to you is grumpiness or criticism or a failure to engage in your joy with you, that can be a very confusing experience then to know what that experience was. Was that joyful or was it not? It seemed to get me into trouble. It seemed to get me to be criticized. And so just that epistemic mirroring, that's, you know, inaccurate epistemic mirroring, can leave us feeling very confused. And I had to do quite a bit of work on just being able to identify what my emotions were of enjoyment. And I think there's a huge crossover neurobiology between, for example, excitement and fear. It's the same kind of response. There's an amber zone response, except excitement is where it's safe. Fear is where it's dangerous. Now, when you've lived where everything's dangerous all the time, then you quite naturally, I think, just, it's never safe. And so an experience of excitement has always got an edge of danger and fear to it, for all the reasons I've stated. So it can be quite a new experience to be excited about something without there being fear attached to it. And one of the things that really helped me on that, it was something specific that I had to work through, was, for example, learning to do public speaking and so on, in that I would have this fear of doing it, understandably, as most people do. But I remember someone saying to me, you know, those feelings of butterflies in your tummy, the feeling that you feel slightly kind of shaky, the feeling of jiggliness and so on. And they said to me, you can interpret that as fear, or you can interpret it as it's excitement and it's energy to get the thing done that you're wanting to do. Because ultimately, I wanted to do the public speaking thing that I was doing. I wanted to achieve it. I wanted the outcome of it. I wasn't being made to do it. It was something that I wanted to do. And so I was quite excited about it. And there was fear as well. And it was just, we just worked through over a period of, you know, a number of sessions, a number of weeks on it. The thought that came into my head at the moment that I was facing up to this, it's like, is this exciting or is it fearful? And we looked at it in terms of, you know what, I can choose which way I interpret it. And that if I interpret it positively, if I say, oh, look, butterflies in my tummy, ah, that's my body gearing up to give me the focus, to give me the energy, give me the sense of to get this thing done that I want to do. That totally transformed it, because previously my inner dialogue on it was like, oh no, I've got butterflies in my tummy. Oh no, I'm nervous. Oh no, I'm anxious. What if I get too nervous? What if I get too anxious? What if I can't think of what to say? What if I make a mess of it? And so I'd start to sort of spiral down with that negative self-talk. Because previously I'd always assumed that the interpretation that comes to our mind, the meaning that we make of something, that is true. And so if I'm feeling afraid, it's because it is something to be afraid of. And so we did a lot of work of me just kind of grabbing a hold of, oh, what's my inner self-talk? How am I interpreting this event? And then me kind of going, do you know what? I can choose to interpret it differently if I want to. So yeah, I need to do a risk assessment. Is it actually dangerous? Am I actually going to die? Am I actually going to be mauled by a bear here? But if I can objectively say, no, this is okay, this is safe to do. You know, I'm going to go to Old Trafford to watch United play. It's fundamentally a reasonably safe thing for me to do. So those feelings of butterflies in my tummy, no, that's excitement. That's not fear. And yeah, there will be some fear underlying it. There's nervousness, anxiety, there's crowds to manage, there's making sure I don't get lost, making sure I don't get mugged, you know, all those things. But that's manageable. I can do that. And let's not focus on the fear element of it. Let's channel that energy as my body giving me the means to be able to go and do this really exciting thing. So I, following on from that, I really had to learn to enjoy things that I was enjoying, rather than having a constant narrative in my head at the time of all the things that could go wrong with it, all the reasons why I shouldn't be there and I shouldn't be enjoying it. And to learn to be quite mindful when I was actually enjoying things, of like stopping and noticing, go, wow, this is amazing. I'm really loving being here. And kind of stopping the inner self-talk of all of my shame gremlins saying you don't deserve it, all of my kind of, you know, amygdala-driven fears of saying, yeah, but something bad might happen. You know, I was at a concert recently, and I caught myself sitting there waiting for it to start, thinking, what if there's a bomb? What if there's another arena bomb? I wasn't at the Manchester Arena. It was at another Manchester venue. But I started, and you start to realize that you're going down this rabbit hole of looking for danger and looking for the exits and starting to look at everybody suspiciously. And it was that kind of like, oh, hang on, just notice that's what I'm doing again. Let's stop that, and let's focus instead on noticing everything that's fun and amazing about being here. And it was like that kind of switch from fear into gratitude, and that switch into kind of like, I can't believe I get to be here. This is amazing. This is so interesting. You know, look at all the really interesting people that are here in the audience. It was mainly middle-aged women, to be fair, but it was still really interesting to see who was there and to people watch a little bit, and then to see how the stage was set up. And so directing my attention towards enjoying it and really putting the brakes on myself. And I know that happens to me. It happens to me all the time. And of course it does. I've been in a lot of fires throughout my life. So of course my smoke detector is smelling smoke everywhere. But I don't beat myself up for that anymore. I just notice that I have a tendency to do that and then try and stop it. And move instead to going, okay, direct my attention away from the smell of smoke, and direct my attention to the thing that I'm enjoying. So I've had to learn to really enjoy myself as well on it. And that's a skill, and it's not a skill that comes, you know, automatically, especially if you've not had that being mirrored to you as a child, if you've not had, not grown up in a kind of a joyful place as well. An experience I had a few years ago, I was on holiday with a couple, and I can't remember where we were. I think it was Cornwall, somewhere like that. And we were out at lunchtime ish, and we were kind of deciding where to go for lunch. And yeah, there was this place that was there, and it was okay. It was a picnic spot or something like that. And you know, I was kind of getting hungry, and I was ready to eat, and so I was like, yeah, suits me, that's fine. And this couple then went into this kind of like quite involved discussion between themselves about, well, what would happen if we drove around to another part of the coast and we went there, and I was just like, well, this looks okay to me. You know, it's all kind of nice. And I was slightly annoyed at their kind of like, but we could find somewhere better. Because I was like, it's good enough, isn't it? But it was so interesting once I got over my annoyance at my kind of hunger. So interesting to follow their thought process through. And I'd never seen anybody do it before, that they, it was like they valued themselves so much. And they valued the opportunity to have a joyful experience so much that they were wanting to make the most of it. And they were tracking which way the sun was coming. And they said, I think if we go around there, we'll have the sun for longer. And I think the view from over there will be far better than the view here. And I remember just like watching them in awe, in this sort of like, well, you're not just having a, you know, a good experience. You're wanting to have the best possible experience you can have. And, you know, we got back in the car and we drove 10 minutes further around the coast. And we found an absolutely spectacular place to have lunch. And it taught me such a lesson that I was so used to not having good experiences that even when I got used to a good experience, I'd just make do. It's fine. That's okay. That, like, that's my level. I've got used to it being maybe okay for me to have a not bad experience. And then I settle for that. And the experiences I had with them, with other people, taught me to push for more, to have peak experiences, not just okay experiences. But I had to learn almost like the skill of that, almost the way of thinking those things through, because I just, that never occurred to me to consider where the sun was going to land on the land for longer, you know, during the afternoon. And they were experts in enjoying themselves. And so that was another part of it, that I had to find people to hang out with who were really good at enjoying themselves, who were really good at positive emotions, so that I could watch them and observe them and learn from them. And it came just naturally to them. It never occurred to them. It seemed not to do that. And I think sometimes when, you know, we've got a trauma history, when things have been really tough, it's natural for us to hang out with other people for whom it's been tough. And there's a lot of benefit in that. And there's a lot we can gain from that, of feeling it's not just us, and so on. But I had to learn as well to hang out and to find people to hang out with who had skills that I didn't have, who had skills of joy and skills of relaxation, skills of enjoying themselves. So I've learned over the years to hang out with those people, but to ask them questions as well, and to see, what do you do when you're on holiday? What do you really enjoy? And when you're people watching in a cafe, what are you looking out for in that? Because they're things that might not have come naturally to me. You know, other people that I've been on holiday with that you know, go to the coast, and they love just spending an afternoon looking for crabs in rock pools. And I remember the first time I was with them doing that, I was like, I do not understand what they're doing. Like, what's the point of this? Where, what are we achieving in this? And I talked to them about it to understand why they were enjoying it, how they were enjoying it. And once I understood it, I grasped it, and then I had the experience of it. It was just like, oh, I want to do that again. You know, I went fishing with someone on their boat, and I'd always been like, what's enjoyable about fishing? I don't understand. It's just sitting there not doing anything. And as they sort of say, oh, but look at the view, and look at the clouds in the sky, and look at the reflections in the water, and listen to the sounds, and see how relaxing it is. Like, oh, okay, I didn't understand that before. So I've had to really learn how to enjoy things. It's not come naturally for me. And I've had to learn to trust in good things, that they won't get taken away. You know, I grew up in an environment where there was a lot of here, you can have this good thing. The moment you step out of line, it will be taken away. So there was a lot of control and coercion within, you know, physical material objects, Christmas presents, birthday presents. There was a lot of threat around it, that if you don't behave the way we want you to behave, we'll take it away. I didn't grow up with a sense of unconditionality for good things. that you can have this good thing just because you can, just because you're a human being. It was always connected to, performance in some way. It was performative. And so I've had to learn to do that towards myself as well, not sort of say, okay, well, if you achieve this, 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 and this, then you can have this for your birthday. And if you do this, this, then you can have a day off. If you do this, 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 then you can enjoy yourself. I've had to learn to turn it around almost and put the good things in my diary first, and they're unconditional. And so, you know, my diary gets full, maybe not full enough, but it gets full of, you know, I really love sporting events. And so I've got all of my Manchester United, you know, matches in the diary. That gets prioritized above everything else. Cricket that I go to, some concerts that I go to, you know, other things like that. And they get put in unconditionally for myself. Whereas I grew up where those things were a reward for good behavior. And now they're not, I don't need any good behavior for them. I get them as standard. So I think it's a lot of kind of like, you know, growing in these things. Not just having these positive experiences, but learning to really relish them in the moment as well. Turning down our smoke alarm as much as we can and saying, no, I'm just going to sit here in the moment, being really mindful in it. All of those sort of experiences together, there's no quick fix for it and there's no simple answer to it, but it's learning to tolerate in it. Now, I haven't really answered the question of what we do when they're triggering. And I think a lot of it is about learning to titrate that sense of triggering. Like, okay, it's too much for me right now to have this big, enjoyable, positive emotion. But how can I learn to live with a little bit every day? How can I learn to enjoy a picture of someone's sunflower? Not my sunflower, I've not bought it, I've not done it, but I can enjoy it just a little bit and keep pushing myself. And I think some of this is about us learning to live with discomfort. So I think it's the most natural thing in the world when we get triggered by something to want to avoid being triggered. And that's where trigger warnings come in. And, you know, there's a whole sort of mindset around that really of avoidance. And that's what trauma is always trying to get us to do, is to avoid the thing that's uncomfortable. And I think that's sensible. Overall, that's sensible. But we also have to learn to get used to being triggered. We have to learn to be able to kind of tolerate that distress a little bit and push ourselves a bit. And the analogy I use is kind of more than an analogy. It's a way that I've learned to do it. You know, I have to do various kind of stretches and strength work for the issues that I have with my spine. And, you know, if I do 10 bench presses, I never do 10 bench presses. I always do 11. Always try and push myself just a little bit beyond what I can do and what's comfortable. If I'm really tired on an evening, which I often am, and I have that, I need to put the dishwasher on, or I need to just tidy up before I go to bed. And I have that kind of feeling of like, I can't be bothered, I'm too tired. That to me is always a challenge, like just push yourself to do it. If I say I'm going to work on a piece of writing for an hour, I don't work on it for an hour, I push myself for an hour and 5 minutes. There's always that, I'm just going to push myself a little bit beyond what's comfortable on it all the time, because I think that trains me to do the uncomfortable things in therapy then, and with uncomfortable, emotions. And as well, it's that sense of like, okay, it's a feeling of discomfort. It's a feeling of being triggered, but it's just a feeling. It's giving me some information. It's giving me some data, but I don't have to obey it. I don't have to be bullied by it. And I think what I found so helpful for that in a therapeutic context was working with therapists who weren't bullied by my feelings either. So I had to see that they were comfortable with me being in distress, if you know what I mean. They weren't comfortable with it, but they could tolerate me being in distress without having to come in and rescue me from it. They could allow me to go that extra one bench press further than what was really comfortable, to push myself. I'm walking for a mile. Okay, I'm going to walk for a mile and 100 yards. And it was always that, finding the edge in therapy of what I can tolerate, just pushing just a little bit beyond it. Not so much that I collapse, not so much that, you know, it's really overwhelming and undoable, but always just saying, come on, just a little bit more. Let's just go a little bit further into that. So every time I wanted to run away and avoid and back down from something, it was working with therapists who would say, well, come on, just push a little bit more. I know you don't want to talk about this subject. Let's just talk around it. Let's just talk about it for 3 minutes. Okay, we're not going to spend the whole session. Let's talk about it for 3 minutes. And then the next week, let's talk about it for 5 minutes. Let's see how we can go. So that they didn't feel sorry for me. They had empathy for me. They had compassion for me. But it wasn't about feeling sorry for me and rescuing me from my feelings. It was saying they're just feelings. We're really sorry you've got these distressing feelings, but it'll pass. You can cope, and I'm here with you. Let's just push through it. And that's the same as a personal trainer in the gym saying, yeah, I know your muscles have got full of lactic acid and they're saying they're tired, but just do that one extra bench press on it, because that's how you'll grow. That's how your muscles will grow, by pushing yourself that little bit further. And yeah, that's got to be balanced with being sensible about it and having compassion for yourself. But it's lots of little ways just in my daily life that I've kind of like learned to have that as mindset. You know, you don't want to take the trolley back to the trolley park, but make yourself do it anyway. You don't want to pick up your rubbish after yourself. Make yourself do it anyway, so that when you find something that's uncomfortable, you're used to pushing yourself that little bit further. And that's really, I think, fundamentally that attitude towards painfulness and distress that's helped me push through it, is to take it as a challenge, not to sort of say, oh, I'm bullied by my feelings and I need to back down in the face of them. Saying, no, they're feelings. I'm going to take them seriously. I have compassion for myself in them, but I'm also going to push myself a little bit on it. It, you know, there's empathy and compassion on one side, and I'm hot on that, really hot on that. But a lot of the work I've had to do with myself is not falling into the pit of self-pity on it. And that's a narrative that's there in my brain constantly, feeling sorry for myself, saying, but oh, I'm in so much pain. I'm so much physical pain. I'm in so much emotional pain. It's getting that balance, and everyone will have their limits on it. And my limits, you know, change. They change around menopause. They change based on how tired I am. They change based on how far away from a holiday or a break I am. But it's just knowing, okay, I'm on a 7 out of 10 limit today, but can I just push that to 7.5? And then I'll back down. I won't do too much so that I fall flat on my face, but I will kind of say, come on. Come on, you got this. And that's you know, what I think good parenting does. You know, a child falls off their trike, grazes their knee, and there's empathy and there's compassion for that. And like, oh, that's painful, isn't it? And giving that support while the child cries. But it's also then brushing it off, you know, rubbing the knee better and then saying, oh, come on, no, come on. Let's get back on your trike. Let's go again. And it's getting that balance, therapist to client, and then getting that balance within ourselves as well.